Hey, just a reminder that friend of the show and sketch card artist Ben Abusada is giving Rebel Base Card listeners 20% off sketch cards in his Etsy store. If you go to etsy.com/shop/KSGeekman and use the code Rebel Base Card, you'll get 20% off of sketch cards. You can find the link in the show notes. All right, let's do the show.
Hi, everyone. I'm Bobby Sussman.
And I'm Nadia Kovacs.
We're the Galaxy Edge Explorers, and you are currently listening to the Rebel Base Card Podcast. Great pull, kid.
You found something.
You found the Rebel Base Card Podcast.
What a piece of junk.
I'm your host, Greg McLaughlin.
He's as clumsy as he is stupid.
Join me as we discuss Star Wars trading cards and card collecting.
We need a statement, not a manifesto.
We'll talk about sets from the original vintage.
No, the one I'm pointing to.
All the way to current releases.
This?
Yes.
All right, let's get started.
Commence primary ignition.
Welcome back, or if this is your first episode, welcome aboard. My name is Greg McLaughlin, and this is the Rebel Base Card Podcast. Great show for you tonight, as my guest is Mike Summer of Wax Pack Hero. He does a podcast about collecting as well as buying and selling of baseball cards or sports-related cards. And after discovering his show, which is also an Anchor podcast, but you can find it in most of your podcatchers, I really liked his takes on basically the efficiency of mailing and doing postage and trying to find the best way to collect as well as, sell cards in a manner that allowed you to maybe save on postage and whatnot, and just trying to find out what, how many cards could fit in an envelope and that kind of thing. Because as the collection has kind of grown, or as you are growing in your collecting of cards, whether it's Star Wars cards or other, you start to accumulate not only duplicates, but you may be accumulating cards that are worth a decent amount of money that you may want to either try to sell or that you may want to trade to other users. And I'm of the type, I just want to get the cards out. Let's just do it. I want to make sure I protect the cards. And I kind of, package them like your dad would be going to the airport, like where you're just packing an extra, all this extra stuff that you don't need, which, protects the cards, which is the most important thing. But also, you may be paying way too much in shipping costs. And, I think what you want to try to do is, further the collecting, you're enjoying it, you like trading, that was the whole point of trading cards, right? But, there's so many more efficient ways of doing it that I really thought that I wanted to get him on, and I didn't necessarily want him to repeat all the stuff that, all the content that he's had in his podcast, because one of the things I admire about it is the fact that he does these, 10, 15, 20 minute podcasts, but he has a ton of content that he fits in it. And I didn't necessarily want to repeat that because I want his content to be his, and I definitely want to have you listen to that podcast, but I did kind of want to get him to expand on a couple of things, and it was nice for him to come on. And as I was this week, after having him on and getting him ready for tonight's episode, I was sending something out, and I thought I was just being efficient, and I screwed something up, and I ended up mailing something to myself. And I have a little postmark here saying postage due, and I'm trying to figure out, because I actually did get this postage from the post office, and I'm trying to figure out. So I'm going to have to, I'm like, well, I've learned nothing from this, from having him on. So I'm hoping that you are going to pick up a whole lot more of it and really run with it more than I did, because I feel in some ways I have failed from getting this back. So it's going to be an interesting trip to the post office later today to kind of figure out what went wrong with this postage as I'm trying to get something out. But on the other hand, like I said, when I had him on, I really thought that he would really add some content. So I really hope you really get something out of this this episode tonight. And if you're getting into trading, and I think, one thing nice about having social media is that you can find other collectors, other people who are into the same hobbies as you are. And if you can get together and you can trade, obviously trading in person is going to be faster. But if you're trading through the mail, this is what it's all about. And you can find those people maybe in hard to reach spots. They don't have a hobby store in their area. So you want to try to get that. But if you can make this easier on yourself to make it less of a daunting project, I think you'll find that you're going to be able to trade more often, or you're going to be able to sell and get those cards out there. And you know, maybe even pay for some of your hobby, which would be the best part, right? Because some of this I always consider to be a sunk cost. But, you know, if I was able to get a very, you know, card that is worth some money that I think that I might want to sell, you know, that might be worth some, you know, a couple of boxes or a hobby box or a blaster box. And that's when you're starting to think like, wow, maybe this is something to where maybe I'm not going to do this as a storefront, but if I am wanting to sell a card, I kind of want to find my avenues, find the easiest way to do it, and find the best way to make sure that I get something back out of it. We'll get to that conversation here in just a couple of minutes. I just wanted to get some other housekeeping out of the way. First off, of course, we have the Clone Wars that kind of began. By the time you heard this episode, the first one will have definitely been out, and pretty amazing. I'll let the other podcast go into the deep dives on it, but if you have Disney Plus or you're going to get it, I do think you're going to enjoy it. My daughter and I really kind of liked that first episode, and you know, there's only going to be 12, and what's interesting, I think, from a standpoint of, you know, it's almost like a second act for Filoni and company to go back, and I think it would have been very interesting to see had they been able to close it out the way they wanted to the first time as compared to now. You're almost like you have hindsight when you're doing this, you know, season finale. So, you know, there's a lot more they can add to it, and I'm kind of excited to see, you know, once they finish this, you know, people going back and kind of discovering all the things that, you know, of course they wouldn't have known at the time, all this extra content that's added to the Clone Wars and even the success of series, like, you know, seeing Kanan in the trailer, and, you know, so it's going to be kind of interesting to get. I think we're just going to get so much more out of this, you know, having it come later. So really looking forward to seeing the rest of the season. And I think this takes us into May, because I think there are, 12 episodes, right? So this is going to take us into the spring. I know there's going to be sort of a drought after that, but I'm really looking forward to seeing some, to listening to some of the podcasts kind of dissect this and, you know, get some of that, the Easter eggs that I wouldn't have known. I mean, I watched a good chunk of the series when it was on Netflix, but some of it I've been kind of going back through, but it's going to be really fun to, you know, we got new Star Wars coming out, and that's always great. So I hope you get a chance to enjoy the Clone Wars if that's something you're into, or if you're kind of on the fence, I'd say give it a shot, because if nothing else, if you're getting on Disney Plus, there's so much other Star Wars stuff out there. It's great to kind of catch up, and I do like the fact that they are going weekly so that I can kind of rewatch this a couple of times and maybe sneak another couple episodes I hadn't had a chance to finish or didn't remember what happened. So it should be fun. Also this week, thanks to, and I believe Fantatrax put this up, we had talked about the Topps Journey the Child set that was going to go in retail stores in April. I was able to see, I think Fantatrax had there, because there was the New York Toy Show that had all the Mandalorian offerings, and they were able to put up a picture of what the retail packaging was going to look like. And since it's kind of a complete set, although there are some inserts, I guess if you bought multiple sets, you would be able to get. But it, you know, it's almost like I don't even want to open this. The box looks really great, and to maybe have a sealed box on the shelf just as is, because it's a complete set. Maybe you'll have to buy two, just like everything else. You know, the one you play with and the one you keep sealed. Maybe that's how I'm going to play it. I don't see any pricing for it yet, but I'm probably in for a box. I think that's got to be a given. And it will be interesting to see, you know, we had the sticker set that was on the Topps Now site, and we have this coming in April. Are we going to see a physical Mandalorian set? I think the jury's still out, but the more they kind of piecemeal that, the more I'm wondering that maybe they just are taking the ideas for this and maybe chopping it up. Don't know. And of course, we also have the Women of Star Wars set that's coming out in March, which also should be awesome. So I'm looking forward to that as well. Next week, at the end of February, is C2E2 in Chicago. That is a big comic and pop culture convention that's here in Chicagoland. It is one of the biggest of the year, although we do have several cons. This is generally, it kind of kicks off the con season here in Chicago. But last year we had a blast. I kind of went there because it was being held at the same place at McCormick Place that Celebration was at. And I felt if I was going to cover Celebration, you know, because the podcast was just kind of starting out, that C2 was going to give me kind of a way to get my feet wet and kind of figure out the angles if I was going to kind of take things, how it was going to sound and so forth. So going back this year, is more of just, you know, going to be an artist alley. You know, it's one of those when you're at a con, you really can't get people to talk for maybe more than a couple of seconds if they're even free enough to talk. So I would like to take the microphones and see if I can get some comments from some of the artists themselves or even some of the people I run into. And if you're at C2, I will be wearing a Rebel Base Card t-shirt. So if you find me, I am bringing a little bit of swag. I still have some buttons left over and maybe a few stickers. So if you find me, you know, you got some swag coming home with you. But I would also like to do some audio there. I may do a quick show from the show floor, like kind of like what I did last year, just to kind of give my impressions. I always kind of like having that immediacy of it to kind of give you an idea what's going on there. And I think it makes a nice start for the year, con-wise. So, and of course, you know, Celebration being the one that we all would like to get to and bring back a lot of content from. So although this, you know, the Star Wars is just one of many properties that you'll see. I know the 501st, the Midwest Garrison will be there, probably some of the Rebel Legion and Mandalorian Mercs, and they'll have a nice little section out there. I think they had I wasn't sure whether the droid builders were there last year as well. Yes, there were. So there'll be a small Star Wars contingent there, and it'll be fun to see some of the cosplayers and see some of the artists who may have also worked on. I do think Bob McLeod is in Artist Alley, and he did a few of the old Marvel Star Wars comics, and I'm kind of hoping maybe I can get one of mine signed. It was one of those mid-70s, mid-80s ones, and he didn't do a huge run. He's more known for the New Mutants, and I know Chris Claremont will be there as well. So if you had a New Mutants one, an older one, that would be fun to get both of them to sign that cover. But I think I'm going to take one of my Star Wars comics and see if I can get Bob to sign it. I think Joe Caroni's going to be there as well. Raz Ortiz, who we heard briefly on the program, is going to be there as well. I think Mike Babinski. So there will be some artists there. I'll see you. Like I said, whoever is going to allow me to stick a microphone in their face, all in niceness, I will try to bring you what I can. But and kind of looking forward to that. That should be fun, taking the day off from work on Friday to go up there. At any rate, once again, it's nice to have Mike on the program tonight. I hope you get a lot out of the episode and know that my penance for this is going back to the post office. I hope you have a better experience, and I hope you get a lot of nice program, and I'll come back after we're done and wrap things up. When you decided to start the podcast, how much research did you go into, and what kind of setup do you have?
Yeah, so when I started, I was looking for a way to kind of build on the website and the blog, and so I decided that podcasting was something that continued to grow, and I had been a guest host on another card related podcast from time to time, and just thought, you know, I think there's room here for me to share some content that's a little bit different than what some other people are sharing. And so I kind of started to do some research on what do I want to do. I knew some people just recorded straight into their phone and used the voice recorder app, you know, and uploaded things there. But I wanted to do something, you know, a little bit more, lead to a little bit higher quality recording. And so, I did some research on some other, on YouTube, really, on what some podcasting setups were. And, I've got a Mac, and so I use GarageBand within the Mac, platform to do the editing and all of that type of stuff. And I stumbled across a setup that just had this Audio Technica mic, and plugs right into the back of the computer, and it seems to be working pretty well. I'm pretty amateur at all this, only being in the podcast being 2 months old or so, and so I'm still learning along the way. But it seems to be a little bit of an upgrade in audio quality that I found from the first few episodes where I was just using the phone recorder. Mm-hmm. And now that I've got the mic and when I can record at home, it seems like it's coming through a little bit more clear.
And I was going to say, if you're diving in using GarageBand, well done. I did my opener in GarageBand, but it's a little, you know, to me, I kind of found it was a little overkill for, you know, a simple straight wave cut. Now, one thing nice about your show is it's pretty much you. So, you know, you don't have to do usually that much cutting. But for me, I also use a Mac, and I wanted a straight, you know, wave editor, and then I also wanted something to record. So I use something called Audio Hijack, which is nice because it can pull in all different kinds of system audio. It can pull in application audio. And so whether you're doing like a FaceTime audio call or Skype, I think it could theoretically do a phone call because you can answer your phone on the Mac if you wanted to. But they also have a partner app called Fission that is a pretty straightforward wave editor. And,
okay.
I find it really, really easy and quick, because I think, and you would say the same thing, it's time is everything. And the more time you spend doing this, and is the less time you spend, less free time you have spent doing your hobby. And as we're going to get into, you're doing quite a lot.
Yeah, I'd say so. I think it, like I said, I'm continuing to learn along the way. You know, I do plan to incorporate interviews from time to time. And one of them was recorded, it was a face-to-face interview that was recorded on the phone, you know, that I've done so far, and it was okay. You know, then I had the first one where I recorded it from a different distance. We use Skype, but being a noob, you know, trying to figure it out, I had to save it from Skype, and then I had to open it up in iMovie and then export it as an MP3. Ooh. And because for whatever reason, I couldn't get it into a manipulatable format going straight from the Skype file into GarageBand. And so had a few extra steps. Like you said, it was not efficient. It ended up working out, but it definitely wasn't efficient. And so I still have a lot to learn when it comes to all this kind of stuff, but I'm kind of a firm believer in dive in, get your feet wet, learn as you go, and get some of that hands-on experience. And so that's the approach I've tried to take so far.
Well, and speaking of efficiency, you know, I'm over here, you know, listening, as you know, when I discovered your podcast and listening to it, going, how am I getting, you know, like I'm taking a lot of the content, and you know, somehow you're getting this into these great 15-minute increments and going, oh my gosh, if my podcast were that long, this would be a whole lot easier. But, you know, the amount of content that is dense, and like I said, I do want to get into that in a little bit. There's one thing just kind of pulled from the headlines, and I think, you know, since a lot of my listeners may be more inclined to listen to, you know, to listen to Star Wars content or collect Star Wars cards, and we have our own drama. You know, the Star Wars universe is full of it. But sure. I am kind of curious how the whole Astros thing has played into the card values for their top players, or had it, or is this just something that the cards themselves are a bit bulletproof, maybe to extraneous events? How does values get impacted by what's going on right now, just to kind of rip from today's headlines?
Yeah, I don't know that I can speak to, you know, a true data-driven scientific answer, you know, specific to Astros cards. I have not looked up the trend on their values, but I think it's one of those things that there are some people that are going to be hands off and don't care, or care a lot about what's going on and want no part of those cards anymore or those players anymore, and then you're going to have another segment who don't really. It doesn't bother them at all. And so there's still going to be buyers for that. I think it will be interesting to see how it plays out over time, but I've not heard of any like tangible, like, yes, all of these rookie cards from some of their big names of Altuve and Bregman and some of the key players have just plummeted or anything like that. I don't know where it's all going to shake out. There's a lot of baseball fans that come down on both sides. Some people think it's the biggest cheating scandal ever and it's a huge deal. And other people say, hey, there's been cheating in baseball ever since there was baseball. It's just now the technology's more advanced. You know, it used to be pitchers doctoring the ball and greasing the ball and, you know, stealing signs just by having somebody out in the field or whatever it might be with binoculars, you know, like, and now it's there's just better technology. And so you have baseball fans kind of coming down on both sides of the issue. And so I'm not sure from a card perspective where it'll ultimately shake out, but personally, you know, I'm not overly concerned about it.
I kind of, you know, it takes me back to when I first started collecting, and Star Wars cards and baseball cards are about the same for me. But I remember, you know, growing up in Ohio, you know, I kind of caught the tail end of the Big Red Machine, and, sure, you know, Pete Rose, of course, was the player or my hero or so forth. But I remember when he, you know, I didn't quite understand free agency back then. So when he went to the Phillies, I was sort of like, I was kind of done. I was like, how can you leave the Reds?
Sure.
And I can kind of see, you know, similarities where you just go, I'm done with these, or I'm done with this particular set, where, you know, emotion kind of play into it. But, you know, it's just one of those where you just go, all right, I'm not collecting Reds anymore. And then I became a Dodgers fan. And I remember my, you know, the 1980, I think they went to the World Series and played the Yankees, I think. And I remember I made it a point then, I had this huge stack of Dodger cards. I mean, you know, like, I didn't mind dupes. I remember I used to, like, collect them by team. You know, or you'd have them organized by team and rubber bands in my shoebox. And then I had this huge stack of Dodgers. And that was the coveted card. Mm-hmm. And, you know, them more than anything else. But it's amazing how, you know, like, I guess all things being equal, those cards are, you know, back then they don't have fancy inserts of that, but it's sort of like the value you place in one thing over another when on its essence, it's all the same.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's one of those things. And I think it's universal, whether you're talking about Star Wars cards or Marvel cards or other non-sports or sports cards. There's so many different ways to collect and so many different angles and focuses that you can have. It seems like, you know, what one person values, somebody else doesn't, could care less about, right? And vice versa. And that's one of the ways, or one of the reasons, that we can pick up and we can have the collections that we have, is because there's things that we value that other people don't. And so we can fill those needs for others, and they can fill that need for us. And so whether it's some people collect complete sets, some people collect only inserts, some people just collect autographs or relic cards, and some people like, you know, sketches, right? And so we all have kind of that different focus, which I think is one of the great things about trading cards in general.
Where does it start for you?
For me, I still like building complete sets. There's a few of the main sports sets that I try to get a complete set each year. And I think a lot of that stems back from when I was a kid and getting started collecting in the 80s. That's what you did. You tried to put together the whole set. And so I still like to put together the full complete top set each year. And then I'll usually pick out maybe one basketball set or one football set to get as well. I mean, for me, having a complete set kind of serves as a historical record of the sport for that year. And mm-hmm. So I know that in the future I can look back and see, pull out my 2016 set, kind of flip through it, and it's like, oh yeah, I remember that player. I remember seeing that guy. And the same thing going back into the 80s and the 70s sets that I've put together over the last few years as well. It's neat to see that piece of history and be able to reflect on the sport in that era.
How many different baseball sets will be released throughout the year? And is it all by Topps, or do other brands bring it in?
Sure. There will be probably 20 plus sets that get released. There's a lot of overlap in players. You know, some of those sets have 100 cards in the set. And then some, like the main Topps flagship set, will have about 1,000 cards. It split into three series. So series one, series two, and series three, 350 in the first two, and then 300 in the kind of final update series. And so it ranges. And, you know, just like Star Wars, there's some of those that are a low price point and some of those that are an extremely high price point. I usually, you know, that's overwhelming for somebody to try to collect it all, right? And so that's why I try to focus in on two or three different product lines, and they'll be about based on each individual release, there'll be about probably 7 different sets that I'll put together. Some through opening packs and boxes, and some just by buying the complete set.
Yeah. Speaking of how many cards are in that, that has to also dictate how you store. Do you do mainly by like kind of like the long boxes for? I can't imagine that many really give themselves the opportunity to be put in binders unless it's a special set.
Yeah, I usually try to do one set in binders, kind of that main top set I'll try to put in binders because that's the one that I like to flip through more regularly. But the rest will all go in long boxes. Yep, like the 800 count boxes or 400 count boxes, depending on the set.
And is there, when Topps releases, let's say, a Series 1, because they just released Series 1, I think last week. So you have Series 1, 2, and then 3, the updates. Is any one of those any more or less valuable than the other?
I'd say it kind of ebbs and flows from year to year. Series 1 always has a lot of demand because it's typically the first set of a new year. For some people on the peripheral side of collecting sports, you know, that's their go-to set. You know, they might just grab that Series 1 set. So there's always a lot of demand there. But for the last few years, the update set has been the one that has retain the most value, and typically that's because the print run's a little bit lower, or at least it has historically been a little bit lower, and it's also loaded with the rookies that came up throughout the year. And so there's a lot of big name rookies that have made their first card in the update series, and so that's been one of those that has held some value. It's interesting that for several years, you would be able to get it still really cheap right after release, but over time, it gradually escalated in price. But these last couple seasons, the prices for update have been high, you know, right out of the gate.
Which is kind of interesting because, you know, baseball cards have gone through, you know, various states of having value and not, you know, the classic junk wax era of, let's say, 87 to 94, where, you know, the industry was overproducing at a great level. And I'm also wondering, you know, how do you feel about the industry as a whole as far as like the last several years? Are they producing, in your opinion, the right amount, too much, or too few?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, the card industry in general is as strong as it's been in years and years. Like it's definitely in a very strong point right now. Demand is continuing to increase, and I think the manufacturers are increasing supply to go along with that. If you listen to interviews from them, they will say they're trying to be strategic about that and not just completely crank the presses. They're trying to increase production to meet the demand while still being responsible with the quantity that's being produced so that it doesn't get back into a situation like the late 80s and early 90s where they were making over 1 million copies of every card and just completely flooding the market. I think there's a lot of debate about that because one of the biggest issues that we see in sports, and I don't know if that same thing holds as true in non-sports, is there appears to be a lot of market manipulation going on between the distributors of the cards, in that the manufacturers sell to the distributors at that wholesale level. Historically, distributors would essentially have a small markup and have just a slightly elevated wholesale cost that hobby shops and other retailers were able to then get that and sell at kind of the suggested retail price. What's happening now is there's such a demand. The demand is so high that those distributors are cutting some of those orders from the retailers and hobby shops. And then miraculously, right at release date, there's more product that has become available at that the hobby shop can pay full retail price for. And there's a lot of speculation that the distributors are kind of gaming the system a little bit to boost their own profits. And so that some to some extent is being enabled by the supply that is less than the current demand. And so, you know, is it where's it going to shake out? I'm not sure, but there's definitely a line that the manufacturers are trying to walk to be responsible, but still meet demand, get the hands or get the product in the hands of the ultimate customers at a reasonable price. You know, and so I don't envy them for the situation that they're in, but at the same time, they're I believe, you know, generating some pretty good revenue at this point.
And I think the very nature of having so many cards out there and you are seemingly collecting different ways means that one of the things that you have been talking about on your podcast or one of the focuses of your, you know, your website and so forth is, you know, collecting and selling and trading and packaging is that you have a high volume of cards. And I think that kind of coincides with some of the feelings I've been having lately of, you know, getting back in a number of years ago, you start collecting and you start finding yourself having a lot of duplicates and a lot of extra product. And, you know, space is at a premium, I would say, in any household. And you want to find, you know, as you get more in the community, you find there's more people I can trade with, which is always, you know, the always preferred. But you end up with a lot of extra product that you probably, that there is someone probably wants that and probably would even pay for that, but getting yourself prepared to move that product, whether I want to, you know, to package it, to sell it, really lends into what you're doing and not necessarily going over all your own content. I mean, I really invite your listeners, if they want to get deeper into this, definitely check out your podcast. But if you could kind of encapsulate it a bit, was there a point where you said, I really need to start, you know, doing something with this to kind of, you know, not only help myself, but to kind of get rid of some of the excess?
Yeah, for me, it was less about the space constraints and more about the financial constraints. And so, you know, I collected as a kid, but I took about a 20-year break from the point where I was in college up until my kind of mid to late 30s. And when I got back into it, the world had changed so much with cards that no longer were boxes $15 or whatever. They were now $50 or $100 or $150 a box. And I was having so much fun getting back into it, but it didn't take very long to realize that, hey, this is going to get real expensive real quick unless I do something different. And I've always had kind of an entrepreneurial streak in me too. And so it didn't take too long for me to say, hey, well, I wonder if I can start to buy and sell a little bit to help offset that cost. And as I started to have some early success with that, it kind of pivoted to an all-out goal of, I want to be able to buy and sell and generate funds so that the hobby for me is completely self-sustaining. So I'm only buying things with money that I've generated from selling other things. And so it started by selling off some of my extra and excess, but now I'm kind of also in a full-on, I will buy collections solely for the intention of flipping those and marketing those and selling those to other people. And so that's allowed me to gradually add to my own collection for free, essentially, while generating a little bit of extra revenue. And so I've been able to buy and sell along the way on a few different platforms. And it's really been a great way for me to build my collection for free, essentially, and have a lot of fun doing it.
And also along the way, you have really found out how to grok the post office and figure out the best and most efficient ways to pack and ship, whether I guess it's one card or whether a small collection.
Yes.
What do you think are some of the biggest takeaways you have found in your experiences at the post office?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a few different things there, and one of those that I've had a lot of success with just starting out was using just plain white envelopes. And at least in the sports side of things, there's kind of people are either, you know, you should never use and send cards in a plain white envelope, and other people are much more open to saying, hey, there's some cards that aren't worth a ton. If it's a more economical way to get it to a buyer or in a trade or whatever it might be, then yeah, go ahead and use it. And what I found is I was able to start making a lot more sales of lower value cards or trades of lower value cards if I was using a white envelope. And if you take care and you take the proper steps to package that in the white envelope, that it really can get there safe for the cost of a non-machinable 70-cent stamp. And so, you know, that's one of the avenues that I've used. And so I wrote an article. One of the first articles I wrote on my blog was I called it The Ultimate Guide to Shipping in a Plain White Envelope. But it kind of walked through the process I used to ship anywhere but from 1 to 10 cards in a white envelope. And it's, to this day, like 2 years later, it's the most viewed article on the site every month, mainly through just Google traffic of people searching about that. And so it's something that I've used as a kind of a foundational way to ship kind of 1 to 10 low dollar cards, things that aren't worth a ton. And then from beyond there, you know, as I started to sell complete sets, or I started to have some bigger transactions, sometimes I'll sell, you know, 400 Michael Jordan cards or whatever it might be. You know, I said, well, there's got to be a way to also make sure that we're efficiently shipping some of those bigger collections. And so I put together another guide where I talk about how, what types of boxes and things like that fit into the different size post office boxes. And so whether that's the padded flat rate envelopes, medium flat rate boxes, large flat rate boxes, et cetera, I kind of put together a guide to say, hey, you can fit so many 400 count boxes in here, or you can fit so many 660 count or 550 count boxes in these, just to help people understand the most efficient way to move cards from one collector to another collector.
Right.
And that's been really helpful. And along with that, making sure people understand that if it's an eBay sale, you can print your postage through eBay, but you can also use your PayPal account to print labels at home and get a pretty significant discount over just walking up to the counter in the post office. And, you know, that can be $3 or $4 a package, depending on when you get into some of those medium or large flat rate boxes. And so that adds up over time, especially if you're doing a lot of trades or have a lot of sales or whatever it might be. And so I always want to make sure people are aware of that as well.
What do you think some of the biggest mistakes are being made when sending and shipping?
Yeah, I think from a cost perspective, is that what you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, from a cost perspective, I think one of the biggest ones is people just paying full retail at the post office counter instead of printing their postage at home, because there can be such a big savings there. And then the other thing is just, I think, using the wrong packaging for the card you're trying to send. You know, I had a collector reach out to me this week. I had put out a picture on Twitter of a package that I had received where the seller who was sending me the package paid over $11, or right around $11, to ship the package, and he could have done it for $7.75. And I said, hey, this is a mistake. You guys need to be paying attention to the best way to package this. And I had a couple other people reach out and said, yeah, I bought a card for 50 cents from a guy. I expected to get it in a white envelope, but it came in a $7.90 priority box. And so somebody literally paid a dollar, but the seller spent $8 in shipping. And there's not really a reason to do that. You know, that
right.
Even if you wanted to send it with tracking and things like that, that could have been done for about $2.75. And you'll see people again ship something that could go in a medium flat rate box or a padded envelope and send it in a large flat rate and spend an extra $8 or whatever that they wouldn't need to do. And so I think just sending things in things that don't make sense you know, when it comes to the sizing of the cards themselves or the smaller storage boxes or whatever is probably one of the biggest mistakes.
And I also think as I was, you know, I pulled in this week, I had gotten I'm kind of holding my hand as a small box, but it's one that's made for cards. And I think probably having, you know, especially the right, not necessarily packaging for mailing, but the right storage for cards that are specifically made probably go a long way in making sure, you know, they go from point A to point B. That help you contain your costs rather than trying to fit them in something that's maybe non-traditional that could end up, you know, in spending more money when you didn't really need to, when you could just send this, you know.
Yeah, I think so. And that's one of the reasons when I wrote the guide to shipping sports cards, I tried to, you know, I even made kind of an infographic with that kind of lays that out, but I put it in terms of, hey, this medium flat rate box will hold 400 count boxes. You know, a padded envelope easily holds 230,000 count boxes. A large flat rate gaming box will hold 550 count boxes. So kind of trying to put it in terms of those standard size collector boxes so that if you're out there looking to pick up some supplies, you'll know what supplies to get if your intention is to ultimately, you know, ship those. And so, you know, taking advantage of some of those types of things, some of these materials you have to order directly from the post office,
right?
Like USPS.com. You can't just walk in and pick them up at a local post office. Like the large flat rate game boxes, you'll typically have to order the padded flat rate envelopes. It's all free, but you have to order it online. And have them delivered to you.
And, you know, as I'm also looking at, you know, one of the things, and I think maybe even Topps could take a quote from it. You know, I'm looking at one of the living set packages, and so this is a plastic container, and it's probably about maybe a half inch, 3/4 inch.
Yep.
And it contains one or two cards. And
right.
It's nice, you know, it basically, you know, I've got a piece of foam on both sides, definitely protects the card. There's a piece of tape. But, you know, do this for a number of weeks and now I have 20 plastic boxes.
Yep.
And I'm like, man, if they could figure out a way to do this either with a piece of cardboard or, you know, something, and definitely, you know, considering the amount of money, I don't mind them getting this. But after a while you start to go, you know, one, what am I going to do with all these plastic boxes? B, you know, it seems like such a waste after a while. Like, I really get it, but I'm wondering, could you have top-loaded this and sent it and saved yourself a little money and also, you know, incurs maybe a little less waste?
Yeah, I wonder about that too. I think one of the challenges in that manufacturer perspective is I don't have a firm grasp on their efficiencies of scale as well, right? You know, the mass that they're doing that or what – negotiated rates they've got with SmartPost, you know, to be able to deliver those, and is sometimes there can be savings that come from uniformity, you know, when that shipper knows that every package is essentially going to be that same size, you know, for those living set orders. I use those cases all the time for orders that I get that hold, you know, 15 to 20 cards or whatever it might be that fit really nicely into those. And then I will stick those into a padded flat rate as well. So I reuse those living set plastic slide cases all the time.
Oh, yeah. Let me know. I can make you a bulk deal for them. Cause it's one of those,
there you go.
And it's not necessarily after a while you're like, I can't, you know, now I need to store these. Cause you know, like I said, you feel bad in throwing them away. And I don't necessarily deal in the volume, but after a while you're like, geez, could you package them another way? That does sort of lend into when you're collecting. How do you kind of attack the Topps now? It's definitely its own thing that they're very attractive cards, but the price point's a little higher. Well, at least, you know, maybe for me. But I'm wondering, as far as like when you're trying to, you know, that does maybe eat into your collection money if you are kind of attacking that and then maybe even trying to flip them or move them around.
Yeah, so I don't really go after the Topps Now cards at all. And that's just not not an angle that I've gotten into. Now the living set I did get into, and I do have the complete baseball living set from card one all the way through the current cards. And it is a little different. It's one that's non-traditional for me because I'm not usually all about paying, you know, $5 per card, you know, right, for a set. But there's just something about the unique nature of it only being available for a week, and it's going to be a set that kind of goes on and on and on, that kind of appealed to me. And it was one of those that, because I've been, successful enough with some of my buying and selling opportunities, I was able to have enough of those extra funds that I was generating from that to be able to cover the cost of the living set, that I've continued on with it. And I really enjoy that living set, but I have not really gotten into the Topps Now or some of the other kind of on-demand products as much.
And it's also, I think, interesting, especially with the living set, whereas, you know, the first maybe 2, 3, 5, 20, you know, it's almost something that builds its value over time, in that now, you know, the on the baseball side, it's been going on for at least a couple years, and I know we're into the second year for the Star Wars, and you're getting up to, you know, 77. Once you start getting, you know, a certain number of cards, it almost seems like now there's more of a legitimacy to this set, and you're going, okay, instead of just these one-offs, and that's really cool. Now you're like, wow, this is actually, you know, it feels like it has the fact that they keep going adds weight to its value as a collection.
Yeah, on the baseball side, I feel like it's moving to a situation where it's almost the opposite thing now. When it was first getting started, that first year or year and a half, there's that inverse relationship between the least popular players have the lowest print runs, which ultimately led to them having the highest prices, right?
Right.
And in that first year and a half, there were people who were unaware of it for several months, but being that they were only 5 or 6 months in and there was 40 or 50 cards to get caught up with, there was a lot of demand that was driven from new collectors coming in and going back and buying the initial cards, right? But now it seems like we're almost at a point where we've hit like the 2 year mark, or we're just coming up on the 2 year mark, and there's so many cards that new collectors are like, listen, I can't go back and get all of these, so I'm not even going to try. And so as some people have gotten bored with it, anybody new coming in seems to only be going after certain players. There hasn't been that demand to go and get the full run. And once that demand slowed down, that really started to diminish some of the values of those cards, because it's gotten to a point where it's so overwhelming to try to catch up, and the cost is so high to catch up that started to limit the values of some of these cards. So on the baseball side, the values of those living set cards have really started to come down. And it used to be kind of a way to make guaranteed money. You know, you'd buy it at release, and a month later, there are so many people trying to get those cards from the prior month or 2 months that people were getting double, triple, or more of their original cost. But now it's not uncommon to be able to find some of these living set cards for the release price or less, even months or weeks or months after their release.
Is that a thing maybe with sports? We'll pick on baseball, that, you know, because this is such a tried and true media, baseball cards, that something new in the market does sort of garner attention. And I guess, you know, it's something where you may need, you know, you want to jump on it fast, but, you know, over time people kind of tend to gravitate back towards the tried and true or the traditional types of cards.
I feel like there's a weird mix sometimes with collectors, in that some of them love things that are brand new and they will go after anything new, but at the same time, as soon as there's something else new, they just jump over to that. And then there's another set of collectors that hate anything new and only want traditional. You know, I want it the way it's always been. And so don't mess with my top set, you know, whatever it might be. And so there's that interesting mix. But I think for the most part, what I've observed over these last couple of years is there's a lot of collectors who just move on. There's so many, like I said, there's going to be 20 something releases this year, baseball card releases this year, and people just move from one to another, and something's hot and super popular because it's brand new and just came out. But as soon as that next set gets released, people forget about it, and, you know? And so, I don't know what the right answer is there, but yeah, it's one of those things. I think for the most part, people are just kind of chasing that brand new thing.
And that leads me into my next question in regards to one of the bigger things over the last, you know, it seems like the last several years are breakers, people who go and use, you know, YouTube or Facebook Live or whatever to crack open packs, whether they're a base card pack or a really expensive one. How do you kind of fall in terms of, do you do it yourself? Do you open packs live, or is that just something that I just really don't want to get into that realm?
Yeah, so I've never bought cards through a breaker. For me personally, as a set builder, I want to get all of those cards and have all of those cards myself. And so breaking has been something that's definitely helped to grow the market, and it can be great for people who only collect certain players or only collect certain teams, because what they'll typically do is, you know, sell a spot in that break. And so they'll open multiple boxes or a whole case of a product, and the customer will say, we'll get to choose. I get all the Cubs cards, or I get all of the Angels cards, or the Texas Rangers cards, whatever it might be. And so if that's the only team they care about, it's perfect for them because they pay a smaller cost. They don't have to mess with a bunch of cards they don't want, and they only get the cards that they do want. But I, as a set builder and somebody who will go ahead and sell any of the cards that I don't want on a variety of platforms, that's not something that really appeals to me. And so it has its place in the market, but it's not something I've participated in. I do open cards on YouTube and open some of the boxes and put that out on YouTube. More so just for the educational purpose of helping other people see what is in a typical box, or what my example has been. I've never done it to sell a spot. You know, I don't sell those spots. It's just a kind of a record of the cards that I'm opening.
And do you find it, you know, now I'm finding when I buy cards myself that I almost wait and open them, you know, I wouldn't say to the public, but I open them online because I do like the aspect of sharing a little bit. And sometimes, yep, you know, you feel like, well, maybe I'll buy an extra one. I can open that myself. But you almost start to feel like, well, like I do, if I buy this and I talk about it, I probably should let people see what I'm, not only what I'm doing, but sort of experience the fun of opening packs. Yep. I don't know if you're in the same boat when you get a pack, whether you feel like, do I keep this to myself or do I share?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So that's one of those things that some of my friends just don't get. You know, they'll be at the hobby shop and they'll buy a box or they'll buy a pack and they'll open it right there at the shop. But for them, it's because that's where they're able to share that experience, you know, with the people that are around at the shop. For me, having the website and the YouTube channel and some of those other things, my place to share that is online, because this helps create content for me, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to be writing an article about this set. So having the YouTube video of me opening the box or opening some of those packs is a perfect complement to that written article, right? And it gives me more YouTube content. So for me, I share that through opening online, recording those openings. There'll be some times where if I have, like I just yesterday picked up a couple boxes of the new Donruss Racing cards that just came out. And for this one, I'm going to be trying something different. Instead of opening them all live, I'm just going to kind of do a recorded recap and show some of the notable cards or some of the ones that stand out to me, just to see how that goes over. But I'll probably only do that for one box, and the other box I'll just open at my own leisure, you know. And and so there are times where if I'm buying multiple boxes of a product, where I might record one of them for kind of the YouTube channel or the blog, but at the same time I'll just save the other one, or I'll open the other one kind of as I want, and not worry about the recording aspect of it.
What's been some of the most interesting feedback you've gotten, or most surprising feedback you've gotten from doing this?
Yeah, I think some of the most fun feedback. So I started the website to help educate returning collectors like me on kind of what's going on and what they might be able to expect, and to be able to share some of these thoughts on how to have a self-sustaining hobby. And that's really the angle that I narrowed in on for the podcast. It's kind of combining that business side and collecting side of the hobby to help show how you can have a self-sustaining hobby. And so having people start to respond that they're doing the same thing, and that they're able to take away some of these things that I'm sharing and start to see some success in doing that themselves and lowering their cost to collect, that's been really rewarding, because that's the whole point of what I was trying to do and what I'm aiming to do with this. And so seeing people say, hey, I've never sold a card before, but thanks to you, you know, I learned how to do that, or, you know, I never even considered approaching selling cards that way. That's been great. Or I had no idea that you could print postage on PayPal and save money. Hearing those types of things has been super rewarding. And then, you know, it's also interesting to me that there's a handful of people who will argue with me about my own results, you know. And, you know, I'll post an example of something that I sold and say, hey, this is something that you can do. You know, this took me 5 minutes and I made $2.50 on it or whatever. And they'll argue with me, you didn't make that. I'm like, well, yeah, I did. It didn't take you 5 minutes to do that. I'm like, yeah, it did. You know, and so hearing people still kind of push back that this isn't possible, you're always going to lose money, you can't make money on cards, you can't have a self-sustaining hobby. Like, well, no, I'm doing it. I'm sharing examples of how I'm doing it. And so having some people who still like refuse to acknowledge that despite, you know, facts, is interesting to me.
I also like, in listening to some of your latest episodes, that, you know, yeah, it's when you're talking about the scale you're working at, it does add up. And that's something to where we're looking at a base card, you're going, well, there's not a lot of value, I want to move that. But there is not only value there, but there is a value in saving, not having to either. Like I said, even if you're just trading it amongst yourselves, I know a lot of times on times where I've had to trade internationally, you're going to take a bit of a hit on that. But even if you're just moving an insert set, or you're just moving 5 to 10 cards, it's like, look, there's a way to do this. And even if you're saving 30 cents, 50 cents, I'm like, it does add up. And we're talking about, you know, that they're not stopping. You know, the industry is really strong. They're putting out sets. And there is a way to, you know, imagine if you could do all this and you're not spending anything, or at least it's going back in and you're not spending any additional. Well, there's money you're saving, putting somewhere else. You know, put some money in the car, put some money in the house. Yeah. You know, for us, it's a sunk. Some of us, you got to get out of the mindset of it's a sunk cost.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. And, you know, it does take a little bit of work, but there is opportunity there. And I think one of the things that I've been most successful with is finding cards that many people just write off as worthless and turning them into value, right? Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the buying and selling I do is with base cards. And a lot, there's a, at least on the sports side, there's a general notion that, oh, base cards are worthless, they're a waste of time, you know. And I'm able to pick up collections of these base cards for a penny or 2 cents, or sometimes even less, and sell them for 18 cents to a quarter a piece, right? Or put together a set and then be able to sell and market that set. And I've found success turning these cards that some view as worthless into legitimate, you know, some legitimate money that really helps offset some of that cost and build up a huge inventory of some of these base and insert cards. And I think that same thing, you know, this whole concept of a self-sustaining hobby applies whether you're talking about sports or non-sports. And right. So it's really the people might be different, or the characters might be different, or the sets themselves might be different, but the concept of, in general, of turning your extra cards into a little bit of revenue or buying and selling some of these collections, that applies whether you're talking about sports or non-sports.
Right. And even if you're doing some horse trading between people, there's a smart way to do it to where you can get, you know, I think if both parties can figure out, you know, the nuts and bolts of the postage machine, or, you know, the postage yep. part of it, then you can do it more often, and yep. you're moving cards back and forth, and that's the whole. It's a trading card, and you know, we have to, you know, yes, one of the things that the online communities make it nice is, like, you can identify people that are, you know, have that same passion, have that same love of the product that you do, and if you're making it easier for you to move cards back and forth or selling cards back and forth, you get to do it more.
Yes. Yeah. And that's what it's all about, right?
Exactly. I wanted to ask, in the time you have kind of, you know, grown the brand portion of Wax Pack Hero, what are some of the successes that you have seen, or some in building your own personal brand?
Yeah. So when I started the blog first, the website, waxpackhero.com, and a couple of years ago, I had no website background experience at all. And so I was kind of starting from scratch and learning. And then the same type of thing as I started to market that more and decided that I needed to get more engaged online as a brand, you know, I started to utilize Twitter predominantly as a platform to engage. And the success that I found really has just come with engaging with the community, the card community, and doing what I can to serve and educate and give back and answer questions that people are throwing out there, and try to create content that people find helpful and is educational. And I, as I've continued to do that, people, I think, have started to see some value in the things that I'm sharing. And, like, you know, like I said before, when I get some of those thank yous of, hey, I didn't know that, that's so great to know or understand, that stuff, I think, started to help build some credibility. You know, there's so much negativity sometimes that can come through on social media, and I try for the most part to be as positive as I can and not completely overlook the scandals or the some of the drama that exists and not turn a blind eye to it, but also try to highlight and focus on the positive that exists as well, and not completely dwell on those negative things. And so I think that aspect of positivity is something that's helped a lot too. I listened to Gary Vaynerchuk, and he's, you know, great at building a social media following, or building a brand, your own kind of personal brand. And a lot of the tips and things that he gives about how to build awareness for what you're doing are things that I've tried to follow as well. And I think some of that has really helped continue to help people find the podcast, or help people find the website. And so, you know, those are a few of the, I think, the basic things that I've tried to do. But, you know, when somebody reaches out, I answer every direct message. I answer every email. I respond or say thank you in the YouTube comments or the blog comments and things like that. And so, you know, I'm just so appreciative that anybody cares to listen, or that anybody cares to read what I'm putting together, that I can't help but engage when somebody takes the time to reach out, to take the time to respond and say thank you for that. And I think those things help.
What are some of the things you're going to be working on in 2020?
Oh, some of the things that I'll be working on 2020 is continuing to build out the podcast, continuing to expand on the website. You know, the podcast being new, only 2 months in, there is, like we had talked about before, there's a time commitment to that. And so continuing to learn some of those podcasting skills and coming up with a content strategy to be able to continue to crank out that helpful comment or content is something that I'm going to be focused on. And then figuring out how to merge that so that it ties closely with the things that I'm putting together on the website are a couple things kind of from a technical or administrative side that I'm trying to do. I wanted to tell a cohesive story, but there is a different audience that comes to the blog as then comes to the podcast at this point. And so being able to intertwine those things are a couple things that I'm going to be working on there. From a collecting perspective, I've got, you know, a few goals of putting together some of the kind of core sets that I like to put together. And then I'm also working on putting together the 1969 Topps baseball set, which is kind of a vintage goal for me. And so I like to try to put together one of those older sets each year. And so that's something that I'm going to be focusing in on as well. And then, you know, continuing to learn, you know, there's, I've started over these last few weeks, since you and I had started to interact a little bit more, you know, I'm listening to your show and a couple of the other Star Wars related podcasts to try to learn more about the Star Wars side of the industry and some of the Marvel sets and the Marvel cards that are out there. And, you know, so I've been trying to broaden my understanding and broaden my knowledge as well. And I always try to continue to learn from that. And I'm also part of a brand new podcast live call-in show that's hobby related called the Hobby Hotline. And today is actually here on Saturday the 15th is the second ever show, but it's a podcast of or a live call-in show that's hobby related that a variety of hosts from other trading card podcasts are all kind of coming together and have a rotating group of hosts where we take questions from collectors and talk about topics, and we're trying to get that off the ground as well. And eventually we want to be able to talk about all different sports, non-sports, you know, whatever it might be in the card industry. So that's another project that I'm a part of that's just getting started that we'll be focusing on this year too.
Oh, that sounds really exciting. I know I could probably, yeah, speaking of time and efficiency, I should probably let you get to that hobby hotline, but, I could probably talk to you for another hour or so, but, that's why you have the website and the podcast. But where can people find you and your content?
Sure. Thanks. But yeah, I'd love to talk whenever, but yeah, they can find me at waxpackhero.com. Or on Twitter at TheMikeSummer, or you can search Wax Pack Hero on Facebook or Instagram as well. But probably Twitter is where I'm most active, or reaching out through the website.
Excellent, excellent. I just want to say thank you so much for being on the program. I hope we can get you back at some point. But I think this was a really good talk for folks. Like I said, whether you're sport or non-sport, you know, when you get back into it, or if you're a longtime collector and you gather this, being able to enjoy the hobby, being able to have it sustain itself potentially, or at least finding easier ways and cheaper ways to go back and forth and interact with other collectors, is content that everybody can get something out of. And so I really appreciate you kind of really diving into this. It's what I love about where we are now online, is that we can have these focuses that really give people a lot of great content, but in an efficient manner. My only thing to you is that, you know, I originally thought my podcast was going to be about a half hour long. So I would say there is a danger of the longer you do this, the longer those podcasts are probably going to be, unless you're really, really careful. But I have a feeling if anyone can pull off the 15-minute sustained podcast, it's got to be you.
Well, I'm going to try. Yeah. Speaking of that, it's so new to me, right? I sometimes forget. I should probably tell people that you can also check out the podcast, the Wax Pack Hero Sports Card Minute, and that's available on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or any of those platforms. But that's really where I try to narrow that focus into providing things that help make it a self-sustaining hobby. And so, yeah, check out the podcast too, please.
Excellent, excellent. All right, Mike, it was a pleasure talking with you, and hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Yeah, thanks. Anytime.
Once again, my thanks to Mike Sommer for being on the program tonight. It was a pleasure to get a chance to talk to him, and I suggest you check out the Wax Pack Hero podcast for a lot of good tips on shipping and buying and selling of cards. If you have any feedback for tonight's episode, you can reach out in a number of ways. You can leave an Instagram comment on the post for this episode. You can also DM me at Rebel Base Card on Instagram. Or on Twitter, you can find me also at Rebel Base Card, as well as Facebook. You can also email the program, greg@rebelbasecard.com. You can find all the show notes for this and all episodes on the website, rebelbasecard.com. In a Star Wars card trader app, you can find me at Cornfed Tech. If you are a sketch card artist or Star Wars artist or collector, cosplayer, and want to talk about your work, your craft, your passion, drop me a line and maybe we can work something out. You can also do me a favor and leave a comment and a review on iTunes or wherever you get this podcast. It helps get the word out about the show. Otherwise, keep those cards out of the hands of the Empire, folks, and I'll talk to you soon. The music for this podcast is brought to you under a Creative Commons license from Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails. This is Discipline off the album The Slip. This podcast is not affiliated in any way with Topps, Disney, or Star Wars, nor is it endorsed by Disney or Lucasfilm, and is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. All names and sounds, and any other related items, are properties of their respective trademarks and/or copyright holders here in the U.S. and abroad. The official Star Wars website can be found at www.starwars.com.